Back together again, you and I chatting it up Thursday style, May 22nd, 2025 on Connecticut Today. I kicked off the show looking at a controversial proposal being debated in Hartford that could cripple the power of local planning and zoning commissions across the state. Yankee Institute for Public Policy head Carol Platt-Lebo and East Haven GOP State Rep Joe Zullo also weighed in on what's known as House Bill 5002. CBS News Pentagon reporter Eleanor Watson updated us on President Trump's acceptance of a jet from the Qatari government, while Discovery Institute senior fellow Scott Powell talked about our continued reliance, shockingly, on communist China for several minerals key to U.S. national defense. All right, you have a little assignment from me during the show today, maybe after the show into the long holiday weekend, which kicks off late tomorrow, Friday into Saturday and Sunday and Monday, the Memorial Day weekend, the first kind of unofficial, official slash unofficial weekend of summer. What your assignment is to pay attention to how your member of the State House, there are 151 members of the Connecticut State House, about a 2-to-1 margin for Democrats there. How the State Senate, there are 36 members in the State Senate, about a 2-to-1 margin, Democrats over Republicans in the State Senate. You need to do this, trust me. I'm dead serious about this. I'm not being, you know, hokey here on a Thursday. Hey, the wacky radio guy. You have to pay attention to House Bill 5002, HB 5002 or 5002. It is an omnibus House bill. Those are the words. It is an omnibus bill, rather, I should say, an omnibus housing bill. The omnibus bills are the worst kind. The majority in Hartford does this all the time. They wait till the last minute before debate is to start, and they dump a big bill on the desks of the majority and the opposition, knowing that it'll take time for all the legislators to read it, and knowing that after they do that, if they have questions about a certain part of the bill, it takes time for their lawyers and their legislative assistants to look at it. Okay, so why am I warning you on this? It's a 92-page bill, I've been told. It's an omnibus bill that in many ways will hand control of local zoning to politicians in Hartford and strip many cities and towns of the ability to run in accordance with the wishes of their residents. This is squarely aimed at Fairfield County. Kind of, sort of, in some of the elite suburbs outside New Haven, mainly to the east, Guilford, Branford, Madison, North Branford, North Madison, Essex. But it is squarely aimed primarily at lower Fairfield County, Wilton, Westport, New Canaan, Fairfield, even parts of the valley. So that's where the primary focus is. The secondary focus is kind of sort of suburban Hartford, West Hartford, Simsbury, West Simsbury, Farmington, Avon, those areas. The I guess you would say the exclusive areas there. And listen, a lot of affluent areas want to control their zoning. They want to maintain a good amount of price, and they don't want large congregate-type housing built in those areas. So that's why local zoning has been very tight for years. But make no mistake, the Democratic majority in Hartford is going after lower Fairfield County. They are. They're going after the eastern suburbs of New Haven. They're going after the affluent suburbs of Hartford. Okay, so you may be asking, what's in this bill? I've got those bullet points coming up here. But again, and let's lead off with our question today. This is House Bill 5002. It will give unelected bureaucrats and elected Democrats in Hartford, and if you don't believe me, go research the bill. It's very easy to find. It's a multi-page PDF that is written in legalese that, But fortunately, we have some folks in the state who've gone through this already line by line in the past few hours, and they have broken this down. So we'll do that coming up. We lead off of that today. But here's a question, and I already have people chiming in on this. It's a simple question, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, talk or text. Now, we have anti-discrimination laws already well-ensconced, well-intentioned, and properly in place in this state. This does not have anything to do with discrimination laws. That's not what this housing bill is. But the question is, and it may come to a head with a vote maybe before we're done today, should the state have more power to overrule local planning and zoning commissions on affordable housing issues and housing issues in general? What do you think? You tell me. Do you trust the majority leaders in Hartford? Or do they just want to force your state, again, and force your area in the state, again, Lower Fairfield County, to comply? Or do you think this is long overdue? Here on a Thursday heading into the holiday weekend at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Hey, listen, sometimes people want to live in an area that doesn't, for whatever reason, doesn't have a lot of affordable housing. They don't want to live in tightly zoned areas. They want to, you know, sometimes live in cities and towns that have a little bit of a higher income level. Everybody knows that. Let's just admit that. But if state lawmakers think that's not good, should they be able to supersede cities and towns and come in and bigfoot that? That's a question that has been brewing here in Connecticut over and over and over again. So now there's a bill being debated this afternoon. It may come to a vote today, tomorrow, or into the new week after the holiday weekend. It's a 92-page bill that was finally released, what a surprise, by the majority in Hartford, less than 24 hours before today's vote. It's House Bill 5002. Now, let me read you some of the stuff that's reportedly, and I say reportedly because I have the PDF here, but I haven't been able to make any heads or tails of it here, so I'm going on some people who've already analyzed this. Here's what's in that bill, and you tell me whether or not you like this. And maybe you like this stuff, but you don't like the state telling you you have to do it, your city or town, whether it's Fairfield or Southport or Westport or Darien or Greenwich or Lyme or Old Lyme, West Hartford, whatever. The cities and towns, now get this, cities and towns would be prevent, and this is the main part of this bill. This is kind of the backdoor way here of controlling development when which gives them enough space to wash their hands here. Connecticut cities and towns would be prevented from requiring off-street parking in most new developments, even if the streets are overcrowded. We've talked about that. I've talked about that before. Lisa Wexler on her program, she's talked about that as well. Because a lot of times cities and towns will say, well, we don't want to build this if there's no parking. Where's everybody going to park? Especially if there's no mass transit. So again, this is HB 5002. It would bar cities and towns to some extent from requiring off-street parking in most new developments. So the state could say, no, you cannot require cities and towns to, or cities and towns could not require their planning and zoning commissions to mandate a certain amount, in most cases or in some cases, of off-street parking, even if streets around those areas are overcrowded. The implementation of transit-oriented mandates would be required, requiring dense, multifamily housing in commercial zones generally near transit. So essentially, this would muscle the state into local planning and zoning rules, to where the state, in some cases, would be able to say, no, you've got to be, we're going to make you build housing there because it's near a transit line, a bus line, a train line. This bill, HB 5002, would subject cities and towns to a mandated affordable fair share housing quotas imposed by unelected bureaucrats. So that's how they would shield themselves here once they pass this bill or knock it down. It means that every municipality in the state would be assigned a mandatory affordable housing target, regardless of infrastructure, land use, or any resident input. So understand what's going on here. Now, listen, you may like this. You can call and tell me. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, or you can text me. Same number, talk or text, 333-9422. But you see what's happening here. Because a lot of places in Connecticut, people are saying, well, no, we don't want that. We don't want to be overcrowded. We don't want mandatory housing here and there just because somebody says it. And you know what? Seriously. And I don't want to sound like a jerk here, but I will. But why should a city or town be forced to do this stuff if the people don't want it? Also, the bill would force new unfunded mandates and administrative burdens on local governments, while the actual decision-making authority and resources are diverted to some state agencies and regional authorities. So again, I know they talk about the state. They ain't worried about Torrington, with all due respect to our fine folks in Torrington. They're not worried about Meriden. They're not worried about Durham. This is squarely aimed, and maybe you think it should be. This is squarely aimed at Fairfield County. Now, they'll never say it, but it is. So, again, this is what you have to pay attention to. House Bill 5002. It's being debated on today. The final version of the bill came out sometime yesterday, I'm told. And now they're going to have a debate on it today. That's how things work in Hartford. What the majority does is they get as close to the end of the session as they can. Oh, yeah, here's your copy of the bill. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So cities and towns under this bill would be prevented. And we talked about this, I did a couple of weeks ago with Chris Caruso as well. Cities and towns would be prevented from requiring off-street parking in new developments, even if streets are overcrowded. So that means some developer could get a better chance of building something, say, in Bridgeport. Never mind Lower Fairfield County, but in Bridgeport, and the city and the mayor and the city council could say, hey, wait a minute, there's no parking there. And ostensibly, as Chris and I were chatting about, ostensibly the city or the town anywhere in the area would have greatly reduced power, if any, to say, well, no, we don't want to do that. And this bill would prevent that. It would import mandated affordable fair share housing quotas by unelected bureaucrats. And this has been building for years. One of the main drivers behind this is the wife of the former mayor of Hartford, Luke Bronin, the mayor, Sarah Bronin. I think the name of her group was Desegregate Connecticut. And they went into housing issues because they view this as a racial issue, as many groups do. Before we go to traffic and weather together, Joe in Norwalk today. Hey, Joe, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Great. Thank you for asking. So yeah. Real quick, I think about this whole thing.
Yeah.
And you're right, Lower Fairfield County. Take a look at some of the buildings that have been built in Norwalk on West Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
If you said to those folks, hey, look, we don't need parking for you guys. You have, let's say, 50 apartments in there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But now you have 50 apartments, say an average of 1.5 cars per,
yep,
per tenant.
However they figure thing. It. Yeah. Yeah.
You're looking at 75 cars now on West Avenue.
Yeah,
where are you going to put them?
That's a good question, Joe.
I also have a friend that lives on a street in Norwalk between, mm-hmm, Taylor and Scribner Avenues.
Yep.
they put the town of Norwalk very kindly put nice sidewalks on. But now, many times, you can only get one car by.
Yeah.
And you're going to make that worse if you build some houses over, multifamily houses and other stuff over there. I just don't get it. And the fact that it's not our representatives, our elected representatives doing this, holy cow. So why do I vote? Why do I bother having a town council? Why? Tell me.
Well, again, and Joe, thank you. All very good questions, Joe, rhetorical as they are. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. So, you know, there's always been this kind of firewall, if you will, a buffer between what the big, mighty legislators in Hartford want. And again, like Joe just said, city of Norwalk, towns all across Fairfield County have said, well, no, we want to maintain some of the things that have made property values so high here. And I'm not talking about race. Listen, black or white doesn't matter when you have enough green in the bank. That's the bottom line here. We're way past that. So we'll see what happens here. But again, my question to you, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Should the state have more power to overrule local planning and zoning commissions on affordable housing and other developmental issues in a specific city or town? Joining us to weigh in on this bill, House Bill 5002, that might severely restrict the powers coming up of your planning and zoning commission or your zoning board of appeals. Some cities or towns have one or the other. Some have both. Carol Platt-Lebo, of course, we know Carol well from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, yankeeinstitute.org. Carol, hi, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
Well, Carol, I'm a little shocked. I was just shocked, tongue-in-cheek, to see a large omnibus bill dropped in front of legislators like a day before the debate was supposed to happen. Carol, I don't know. I'm still recovering here. I'm just stunned, aren't you?
Well, stunned or dismayed. Take your pick.
Yeah. So, Carol, I'm sure you folks at Yankee, I know you published some bullet points here, and I know it's being bandied about now as we speak at the Capitol. You've got even some big cities like Bridgeport here, hardly a conservative stronghold, saying they don't like parts of this bill.
Well, no, I think no one's going to like this parts of this bill. None of the municipalities are. Because it really hands control of local zoning to the state politicians in Hartford, and it strips our towns and cities of their ability to run in accordance with the wishes of their residents. And, Paul, we all know that one of the reasons people love Connecticut and come to Connecticut mm-hmm. is because we do have these 169 cities and towns. A lot of them have very different and very distinct local characters, and people like getting to choose where they're going to live and enjoy the places they are and get to participate in local government and get to live in a town where they have a say. And what you have right now is a big, greedy, massive power grab from the state government.
And the thing, Carol, if I'm understanding this from your summary and the other summaries I've read across the web today, is that even though lawmakers would vote on this ostensibly in the House and Senate, and if the governor signs this, the actual control of this, of some of these issues, many of them, if not all of them, wouldn't have to vote on anything again, right? They'll just hand all this administrative stuff off to other unelected folks. Am I understanding that right?
Right. And, you know, that's a new trick that you see happening more and more, that they can get a lot of really bad, really unpopular stuff done. We saw it in some of the environmental bills that mm-hmm. they tried to get through in the past, where what they do is they simply pass, you know, they take one vote and then they vote to sort of delegate all these decisions to unelected bureaucrats. And then they let them make the unpopular decisions that everybody hates because they can't be thrown out of office.
You know, Carol, and the guest is Carol Platt-Lebo from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out online, of course, yankeeinstitute.org. Carol, it's interesting. When I first read about this a few months ago and I was talking to people on the air and off, they said to me, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but they all had the same message, watch how they try to do it with parking. And I said, well, what do you mean? And now I see it here that I guess, Carol, a way to do the classic end around or the end sweep on this stuff to get around people like you and I talking about it is to regulate building by parking rules, right?
Well, what they're trying to do is, in other words, you know, one of the ways that you can control what is happening in your town, and one of the things even the people in Bridgeport object to is the fact that you are that the bill prevents your municipality from requiring off-street parking in most new developments, even if streets are overcrowded. So, you know, you're going to be forced to build all of these new dense development, multifamily housing, but you can't have a requirement that the developer provide adequate parking off the street for all these people in all these new units that they're going to build.
Yeah. And Carol, finally, I'm sure a lot of legislators, whether they'll admit it or not, they feel pressured to vote for this. But the genesis of this is actually who or whom? I mean, I know it's been out there for years. So are these some of the same interest groups, you know, with squarely across here on Fairfield County and some of the richer Hartford counties? I mean, I'm sure, Carol, that you and I know how this works. I'm sure there are a lot of lawmakers. They'll never admit it, but I'll bet you they're squeamish about this. That would be my guess.
Well, I think they should be because, you know, there are a lot of communities where you have affluent people who at the moment vote left a little bit because, you know, they're comfortable doing it and they can afford higher taxes. But I think they'll feel very differently if some of the stuff in this bill comes to pass in their affluent communities.
Yeah. Okay, so the bill is HB 5002. Carol, as usual, please tell my listeners how they can get more on Yankee's policies and policy breakdowns.
Yes, yankeeinstitute.org, and our Twitter account is at Yankee Institute. We also make it easy for you to reach your legislators. And the thing that people have to understand is that local control is important. It's always easier for you to make your voice heard to a local legislator than to a state one. This takes away local control and lets the state run your town. You don't want that happening.
All right. YankeeInstitute.org. And, of course, Yankee Institute all over the place on social media. Carol Platt-Lebo. Carol, great to hear from you. As always, you have the number, so call in whenever you want to.
You bet. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right. We've been talking about House Bill 5002. A lot of people, including some big city zoning commissions, all the way down to the smallest cities and towns in the state, not happy with this. Joining us right now to break down what's in the bill and better explain it, East Haven Republican State Rep Joe Zullo, who represents District 99 in beautiful East Haven, where many of my relatives have resided and still do. Hey, Joe, it's Paul on WICC. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Okay.
And great to hear that you've got a great family in East Haven.
Oh, yeah,
community.
Yeah. Mention the Pacelli name in East Haven, and the cops will say, where is he? No, just kidding. hey, Joe, so break this down. I mean, I've been picking up bits and pieces of this bill, HB 5002. A lot of people are calling up with questions. But before we get into the specific questions, what's the status here of this bill? And the big view here, Joe, is this good or not?
Well, listen, there's a couple ways I can describe it. The proponents of it like to say it's towns take the lead. Quite frankly, I call it follow the leader.
Okay.
And the leader is a big state bureaucratic institution trying to tell towns what to do and how to zone, and because they think that state bureaucrats know better than local stakeholders. I can tell you that it's opt in or lose out.
Yeah.
There's provisions in there that essentially say that if you don't do what the state tells you to do in this proposal, that you're going to lose out on or be deprioritized for certain discretionary grant funding from the state. And then there's just some proposals that just they defy logic. You're talking about eliminating mandatory minimum parking requirements.
Yeah,
and
for
zoning proposals.
That's the one that I've read about. I've done other interviews, and I know some of the city delegations like Bridgeport City Council, they don't like that. So, Joe, is that the biggest backdoor way of trying to do you think, take control of some of the zoning issues here by doing it with parking?
Well, listen, I mean, think about parking as an aspect of a zoning application, right? It's one of the most critical parts, right? Because if you don't have a place to put the cars, you know, obviously people can't live in these places. And so, yes, I do think and parking regulations are one of the most fundamental mechanisms through which towns are regulating certain types of development. And the consequences are scary, though. I mean, under the proposal as it's worded right now, you could have a commercial applicant come in, a big box retailer that's going to generate a lot of traffic, a large restaurant, and they would not have to satisfy any minimum mandatory parking requirements. So this doesn't just apply to residential. It applies to commercial.
I also had a question, Joe, and the guest is East Haven Republican State Rep. Joe Zullo, District 99. Joe, somebody had asked me earlier, and I jotted this down, as far as the parking situation as you read it in the bill, what if somebody is handicapped? In other words, the push here is not to have mandatory parking spaces for these developments, but would that cover somebody who needs handicap facilities or ADA stuff here, or have you seen anything about that in the bill?
There's nothing in the bill, and it's not addressed, but the general consensus is that any applicant would still have to satisfy any federal or other superseding requirements like the ADA. But again, satisfying those requirements might still be complicated. I mean, imagine having just a handful of handicaps or ADA accessible spaces, or less, you know, for example, tactiles on sidewalks as you're approaching some of these places because, you know, they don't have as much parking. So I think there could be a deleterious effect, you know, downstream because of this proposal.
Another question somebody had, Joe, and again, maybe you've seen this in the bill, maybe not, but, you know, towns and cities, you well know, set up their police, their fire, their EMT to service a certain amount of population in an area. Now, if you're going to have developers who get the upper hand here because of some trickery, is there any concern here from anybody how that may be affecting in the future EMS, PD, first responders or not?
That's a great question. And the reality is it's going to cause a huge burden for municipalities. And that's not just a logistic burden, it's a tax burden. Because think about it, there's a proposal in here that says that as of right, you can convert commercial uses or properties to residential uses.
Mm-hmm.
The emergency response and the municipal resources necessary for a residential property are very different from a commercial. You know, obviously educational resources. If the residence, you know, is 55 or older or 62 or older, you have increased AMR or EMT medical visits, increased fire and police presence needed. So not only will there be logistic considerations and consequences, but then there's tax consequences, right? Because someone's got to pay for all this. And ultimately, you will definitely see mill rates skyrocketing because of the additional need to fund these resources.
I noticed, Joe, and the guest is Joe Zullo, East Haven Republican State Rep. District 99. Joe, I see there's the phrase that we've seen over the past few years, transit-oriented development. Is that a fancy way, Joe, and correct me if I'm wrong, of saying, well, if this is within a certain amount or distance from a bus station or Metro North or CT Rail, that it's going to have a better chance here? We want more people living there?
The concept, fundamentally, yes, is we want more people residing around transit because then they'll use less cars, there'll be less effect on the environment, they'll have an easier way to get to things. The TOD proposal that you see in this bill, unfortunately, one of the complications of it is it really doesn't do anything to address the need for affordable housing. It allows developers to build up to 9 units as of right without any affordable components. So two problems with that. One, again, you could go right up to the desk in your zoning department, hand in an application for 9 units, no public hearing, nobody else knows about it, they have to approve it at the desk. And number two, there's no affordable component. So, I mean, developers, if they don't have to, aren't going to build that. So we're not really going to be creating housing for the people that are asking for that housing as we're debating this bill.
So I just want to double check on what you said. So under the bill, Joe, as you read it, if I'm a developer, Pacelli Development, right, and I say, hey, I want to build near X, Y, and Z, so I would be able, without any sort of public hearing, to get a quick approval of 9 units? Is that what I understood?
That is correct. You could build up to 9 units as of right, so long as you satisfy the requirements of the zoning district, the transit-oriented district created by the town. Again, the caveat also being that if the town doesn't avail itself and take advantage of this and create this district, it becomes deprioritized for a host of funding, like steep funding, urban action grants, things like that.
No, my head hurts just thinking of it. Okay, Joe, here's the magic question. Is there enough support for this at this point with the bill as it's written now that you folks got in the last day or two? Will this get out of the House with approval? What do you think?
I can't, as I stand here talking to you, I am not sure. The numbers are obviously close because it was supposed to be called this morning very, very early, and it still hasn't been called. Frankly, and to the majority's credit, I'm grateful that they continue to have the conversation about trying to improve the bill, and we're making some headway. Ultimately, will it get out of that, both the House and the Senate? I don't know.
All right. No, that's fine, Joe. I'm not forcing you to say yes or no. No, that's fine. Hey, Joe, thanks. Republican State Rep Joe Zullo, East Haven, beautiful East Haven, District 99. Hey, Joe, thanks, and don't hesitate to give me a call, man. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity. Always a pleasure.
All right, thanks. There you go. All right, folks, there. How about that? Up to the minute. All right, time for our daily check as to what's going on in D.C. Happy to welcome in CBS News Pentagon reporter Eleanor Watson about this continued controversy over this Qatari jet. Eleanor, good afternoon. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Doing well. How are you?
Very, very good, Eleanor. So does somebody sign for this? And I know the White House and the Pentagon have been kind of, you know, tiptoeing around whether this is a gift, whether it's actually for the president, whether it's for his library. So what's the latest on this?
Yeah, the Pentagon yesterday in a statement said that the defense secretary has accepted a jet from Qatar to serve as Air Force One to transport the president. We have in the statement from the Pentagon, it says that they have complied with all federal rules and regulations. So they're suggesting that there is no violation of a conflict of interest here. Mm-hmm. But remember, lawmakers on both sides were saying even if that's true, it still gives the at least appearance of a conflict of interest because of the business deals that the Trump family does have in the Middle East. As far as whether it's a gift or not, yeah. President Trump, what we know is that President Trump has said that he will use it for the remainder of his term and then give it to his library. Unclear if that is actually how things unfold and the legal restrictions around that.
And finally, Eleanor, you very well outlined the first part of that, but then I keep hearing, and you're obviously hearing this too, the security part of this. And I heard some people saying, well, wait a minute, crews are going to have to go through this thing with a fine-tooth comb, rivet by rivet, to make sure there's nothing amiss here.
That's right. So there are two parts to this. The security concerns, because the jet is coming from another country, got to make sure that they haven't outfitted the jet with anything that could compromise national security. And then the second part is the modifications that are required of an Air Force One. If you go to the White House's website, Air Force One is described as needing to be able to refuel in the air, something that civilian jets don't do. Mm-hmm. That would need to be an upgrade. It needs to have a medical suite that can turn into an operating room if something goes wrong with the president's health, and it needs protection against things like an electromagnetic pulse, which could be caused in case of a nuclear attack. So several modifications that could take potentially a bit of time to make before servicing using this jet.
Eleanor Watson, CBS News Pentagon reporter. Eleanor, thank you. Appreciate it. Have a happy weekend. Thanks.
Thank you. You too.
Appreciate it. Eleanor Watson. I just, every day there's something with Mr. Trump. I mean, okay, he's about a half year into his term. First, I want to shift gears just a bit and welcome to the program Scott Powell. Scott is a senior fellow at the Center on Wealth and Policy of the Discovery Institute. You've seen him and read him all over the place. Wall Street Journal, Investors Business Daily, Newsmax, The Federalist, USA Today, Barron's, The New York Post, The Chicago Tribune. Safe to say, another one of my guests that's got a much better resume than I do. Scott, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Scott, tell us about the Discovery Institute. Before we get to your piece here, which is a real interesting piece on rare earths and a sovereign wealth fund here, talk about the Discovery Institute for just a bit.
Well, the Discovery Institute is a unique think tank, as they call them, a sort of a public policy research center. And it is unique in that it focuses on areas you know, subject areas, problem areas of our society that are not always covered by some of the other larger think tanks. One of its strengths is an area called intelligent design, which was really a school of thought that has come out of science, that science has really disproven the Darwinist theory. That we evolved, that evolution is the way of explaining life. Science, you have to have more faith to be a Darwinist than you do to be a believer in God, a believer in a creator, because there is no explanation for so many of the amazing things from the microscopic cell level of life to the universe that is explainable. Except that there's an intelligent designer in it all.
Got to be somewhere. I've always thought about that. You have a great opinion piece here at Newsmax.com where the sovereign wealth fund, Trump seeks to strengthen the nation. You talk about this, and you've talked about something that I've heard mentioned from other guests I've had on here, the dependency, believe it or not, that even in this day and age of high risk that we have, on China. It's always one of my pet issues to talk about. So explain all this to my listeners.
Well, China, you know, when China really, I think got everyone's attention was under the regime of Mao Zedong. And Mao was a hardcore communist that believed in total control over society. And I mean, his revolution, had many stages to it. One of which was to divide society, to divide parents from their kids from their parents. That children would rat on their parents, and I mean, it was a very the Chinese Revolution was horrible, and the consequences were an absolutely dictatorial regime. Mao was a real, thug-like dictator that eliminated opposition and didn't hesitate to, kill mass killings. You know, you have 100 million people killed in China during the so-called communist revolution. Mm-hmm. So, however, you know, we recognized that we needed to sort of keep China from becoming allied with the Soviet Union, having two enemies allied against us would be a problem. So it was maybe wisdom in the Nixon years through Kissinger who made an overture to China and sort of opened up a relationship with China. And that led to some more enlightened people who succeeded Mao, Deng Xiaoping being a key figure, who appreciated that market incentives are really important if China was really to develop its economy. For China to solve its endemic, agrarian poverty, there needed to be incentives.
Yeah.
And so it started that China became open to that, and then there came to be a recognition that, they would American manufacturing to come to China because of lower costs. And of course, a lot of people got on that bandwagon and we ended up, following that course for several decades. And now, we have whole industries that have left America in terms of their manufacturing. The pharmaceutical industry is totally dependent upon China.
Mm-hmm.
We produce none of the base materials for pharmaceuticals in the United States anymore. That can change, and we hope that it will, but we realize that in the COVID period where we were sort of a hostage to China. But worse is what I point out in this article, and that is that we are hostage to China on these so-called rare earth minerals. It turns out that defense is a very high-tech area of production. These F-16, F-22, F-35 jet fighters, and of course now it's the drones and AI-driven systems. All of these systems require very, very sophisticated electronics.
Yeah.
and they require what's known as that are made up of not just silicon, but rare earth elements like gallium arsenide and many other sort of rare earth metals or minerals. And without them, we couldn't have these, you know, this high-end defense capability. And so what I think most Americans have not realized is that we are now dependent on China.
Wow.
for at least 20 of these rare earth materials.
And 100%. Some of these materials, you say 100%, right? If we don't buy them from China, we can't get them from anywhere.
Well, I'm sure that over time they can be sourced somewhere else,
yeah.
But we sort of relied on China. And so, yes, it's the U.S. government that openly admit that we rely on China for 100% of 20 key minerals and
wow.
rare earth elements that are required for a high-tech defense system.
So, Scott, in about the minute we have left, what is the proposal here from the Trump administration of the Trump White House to say, hey, let's get started on this now to loosen our dependence on this? What could Mr. Trump do if he can follow through on this to help us with this? Because to me, that's frightening. So what can he do?
It is frightening. It absolutely is. Well, I think, you know, this Trump is an extraordinary leader in that he is very transparent, and he sees his role as an educator. You know, you probably seen that they bring the TV cameras right into the cabinet meetings, right? You know, he's very good with the press, opening up meetings with even foreign dignitaries. He opens them up to the press.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's going to educate the American people. I think this is a big area. He's had a lot to do. He can't do it all at once, but I would expect in the next month, we're going to hear about his rollout of a sovereign wealth fund that will involve more development of resources within the United States. And put aside the value of rare earth minerals, we don't really know how much we have in America, but we do know a lot about some of these other assets that are in our ground, that are on American soil. And we have, you know, we have almost $20 trillion of oil and gas
wow.
reserves.
Wow.
And if you put that on the balance sheet of, you know, as an asset, well, you've offset a lot of $36 trillion right there. But we have coal deposits that are worth $2.5 trillion. We have gold deposits worth about $2.2 and copper, we have about $8.4 trillion
Jeez.
Of known reserves. So, but there's much more, but those are just four big areas. And rare earths, you know, it's yet to be determined how much we have. But I just think that we've got two problems here. We need to strengthen the U.S. finances, and that can be done by a sovereign wealth fund that
mm-hmm.
would account for these assets to offset our liabilities. And then secondly, to address our strategic defense needs. And so this sovereign wealth fund can facilitate both of these things, which is very unusual. Usually, if you're going to strengthen the defense,
yeah.
you increase your defense budget.
Sure.
It means higher deficits. It means more deficits mean more debt.
Mm.
But even if we do take on a little bit, even if defense expenditures do go up, if we add a lot to the asset side of the equation through a sovereign wealth fund, I think we will have accomplished something that no other president has done before. It's almost the impossible to strengthen the U.S. National security. That means spend more money.
Sure.
But also strengthen the U.S. financials. But that would happen through a sovereign wealth fund.
Well, folks, check this opinion piece out. You can find it newsmax.com/Scott Powell. With a sovereign wealth fund, Trump seeks to strengthen the nation. We are currently depending on the Chinese government for many of the rare earth minerals that are needed for our defense spending. Scott Powell, appreciate the time. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.